Right, well, we're heading over now to speak to Daniel S. Pearce on his book Tar Heel Lightning, and we'll say good afternoon to him. How are you, Daniel?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Yeah, great to have you on. You probably remember the old Waylon Jennings track there, don't you?
Yes, very much, and that's very applicable to my book, because the person that the Dukes of Hazzard was based on was a guy named Jerry Rushing, who was from North Carolina, and so all the details of Bo Duke in particular, of his life, yeah, are based on the life of Jerry Rushing.
So. No, I didn't know that, but you know, I should just assume that you know, I should have just bluffed my way and said yes, I planned that, and I know exactly what I was doing there by putting that song on. But I just knew it was about moonshine. I knew it was about illegal drinking and so on. But what's amazing me and I found this whole topic fascinating, that we forget, actually, you know, we talk about the 19th century, of course, but it was well into the 1960s when this actually changed, this law. So it's not, you know, it's still quite recent.
Well, it's very recent, because the core law hasn't changed, and that's the excise tax on whiskey that started in 1862 in the United States and made it illegal. And then you had prohibition come in the in the early 20th century, that lasted in a lot of counties in North Carolina. Well, some are still what are called dry counties. And so, but the core law is still there. So there are still people making it illegally because they don't pay the excise tax.
Is the tax quite high as it is right now then on whiskey?
Yes, it is. It's I'm not exactly sure what it is, but it is high. And unless you're making a whole lot of liquor, then you can't make a profit and pay the tax. And so that and it's been real difficult in much of the South in recent years to get a license to make liquor legally, except for parts of Kentucky and Tennessee, which are pretty well. I think internationally.
Why did prohibition come in originally? I'm assuming it was a religious thing, or what was it? Was it puritanical from kind of old British era? How did it all come about?
Well, it was kind of a new thing in the early part of the about the 1830s around there, and I think the movement in the UK and for sure, and I'm not sure about the rest of Europe, but there was a movement concerned about social reform, and a lot of people thought that one of the big social problems was excessive drinking, and at that time in the United States, hard alcohol consumption was quite high, and alcoholism was a real problem. So it started growing at that point. But up until the late 19th century and early 20th century, there really wasn't a religious problem for most people in this region. It wasn't a big deal to be a Baptist or Methodist or evangelical and drink hard liquor or make hard liquor or sell hard liquor. But that changed it's a pretty dramatic thing how quickly this took hold, and then first on local level and then on the state level and then, of course, nationally in 1920 when you had national prohibition.
And what was the driving force at that particular time then? Why did that suddenly grip the nation like that?
Well, again, it was this concern over the social costs of drinking, and it did take on a religious context, because the groups that so avidly supported it were evangelical denominations in particular in the United States. And so and then just very quickly, but there was a real divide between towns and the countryside, where people really needed to make what by then was moonshine, because it was illegal, to kind of keep body and soul together.
Yeah. Now, it's fascinating, because I think wherever there's a law, there's always somebody finding a way around it. And there must have been, you know, you talk about in your book the frustrated feds, I think you call them, and the law enforcement, who must have been aware a lot of the time that it was going on and maybe turned a blind eye. Was that the case, or were they enforcing it to the hilt?
Well, it depends on the enforcement aid. The federal agents who were enforcing the tax, and then later national prohibition, were diligent, and they were the main enforcers. On the local level, in a lot of cases, I mean, one, the local sheriff had to run for re-election, and so you know, that was a good way to alienate voters. And so they would usually, around election time, they would bust a few stills, but not really arrest anyone, you know, just to keep the Baptists happy and keep them voting for them.
All
but,
right.
But for the, and in many cases, they were probably, probably related. And of course, you know, there's a common story that the place that you were most likely to be able to purchase moonshine was out the back door of the county courthouse. And so, that was not an uncommon thing for sure.
And, you know, we talk about the dangers of alcohol, but you did allude to the fact that sometimes alcohol does bring some benefits to it. And there may be those that are disagreeing with me right now as we say this. But if you were to take it all away, there would have been civil unrest, surely. It's almost like they must have known it was going on and allowing it to a certain degree.
Well, again, there was so much of it going on. If you look at the numbers, and you really don't know exactly how much was going on because people didn't exactly advertise their activities. Yeah. Mostly. But if you look at arrest and those kind of things, I mean, huge numbers of stills busted, people arrested, and you got to figure that was just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
So there was a lot. I mean, it was huge. You know, I think there was people were pretty naive to think that by prohibiting alcohol that people were going to stop drinking. That obviously didn't happen. And so it went underground. And to the benefit of the moonshiners, it was the best thing that ever happened to the moonshiners.
And it became legendary, didn't it? You know, written accounts that you mentioned in your books, popular songs. I mean, even just recently, a new Sheryl Crow song came out with the words moonshine mentioned in there again. It's not gone away from popular culture in new songs as much as old songs from the 50s and 60s and so on and before. And movies, you know, we've mentioned Dukes of Hazzard there, Smokey and the Bandit. I'm sure you can list off a whole load of movies that have got this as part of the theme of the movie. So it is massive in popular culture, which makes me think that most people knew it was going on because of the way in which culture has responded to it.
Yeah, well, even the Baptists and the conservatives, the prohibitionists joked about moonshine all the time. It was really ever present. I mean, in terms of, I mean, you had souvenirs being sold all over the place in this state, and you know, moonshine related souvenirs. You had movies, television shows, and that still continues. People are fascinated with it. I'm not totally sure why, but they are totally fascinated with it. There's a very popular show on cable television here called The Moonshiner Show, which follows the exploits of illegal moonshiners. And there's also now what they call a legal moonshine industry that, you know, a lot of people say, well, technically it's not moonshine if it's legal. But this whole corn liquor industry is boomed, and there seems like a new distillery opening up. Yeah. And so it's just incredibly popular.
And it was called, of course, Good Old Mountain Dew as well, and different names used for it. But it must have... I think the legacy maybe is that people are making their own alcohol today, and there's a bit of a renaissance going on, like you mentioned there. Maybe that wouldn't be there if it was big industry that was just purely making alcohol. But it seems to be, you know, it's gone. It almost made a tradition out of it.
Well, I think there's a lot of romance connected with, and people are just fascinated by it. And now, of course, with the internet, you can find recipes, you can buy equipment to make it with, you can buy the ingredients, those kind of things. Most people who make it on their stovetop make pretty disgusting.
Yeah.
but occasionally, you know, I've at least heard, I'll put it that way, that some people can make some really good stuff. But again, everybody thinks they can do it, and a lot of people are willing to try. And so it's there's that fascination and that romance of the whole thing that people want to tap into and try.
We've mentioned one name already. Are there other characters in this story that have kind of been or go down in living memory as people that were really the driving force behind this movement of illegal moonshine?
Well, I think one of the findings, I mean, there are a lot of very famous, I have in the book, this North Carolina Moonshine Hall of Fame, and I argue that that North Carolina, you know, can lay claim to some of the greatest moonshiners in world history. And some of those are pretty well known, yeah. People like Junior Johnson. And again, I mentioned Jerry Rushen. He's not well known, but again, he's the basis of the Dukes of Hazzard. And so there are a number of people like that. The thing that really interested me was how common it was across the state and how common it was across demographics. I was really interested that there were so many women involved. That's a pretty new thing. And so many African-Americans, yeah. And so many Native Americans involved, that it was really was, again, across the board, across the state.
It's a great leveler in many ways, and sorry, it's a great leveler, isn't it? Because depending on your class or whatever, or your background, your race, in America, of course, at that time wasn't the most equal of places to live, and probably still has its issues today. But you know, they all had the moonshine. It was it was part of their culture as well.
Well, it was very much for a lot of poor people, it was kind of an insurance policy. It was something you could do. It was guaranteed you're going to make money if you don't get caught, that is. But in times of economic emergency, all kinds of people, for women especially, it was if you were single, if you're a widow, if you were divorced or something like that, it was one of the few ways that you could make a reasonable living. And so that was kind of accepted in a lot of particularly rural communities in North Carolina that women could they could run a liquor house where they sold illegal liquor out the back door of their house.
Are we in danger of romanticizing it, looking back, rose-tinted glasses, and was there a dark side to this industry and violence like there is with drugs and so on today? Was that the case as well?
It was a case, and there were plenty of cases. Most of the violence, I mean, a lot of it, people look at the chases and the revenuers and the moonshiners and that type of thing. Most of the violence more involved informers. That was when people were likely to get seriously hurt or killed. And the other downside of it is when the government gave up any sort of control over it, is that you lost any control over purity and those kinds of issues. So you never knew exactly what was in it, and it could be pretty dangerous in many cases. You did have several cases, particularly in the 50s and 60s, of lead poisoning and that type of thing because of the way that they were making it. So the families that were involved, I mean, the stress on children and spouses and things like that, you know, this, you know, always being afraid you're going to get caught.
Yeah. I was watching something recently, or actually a few years ago, the history of Christmas, and it was talking about how from the British perspective, England kind of outlawed Christmas for a while and got rid of Christmas pie, and that's why it became called mince pie. And in America, they actually had the Congress on Christmas Day at some point because Christmas was completely outlawed. And it's almost like that kind of puritanical religious thing to ban anything that anybody enjoyed. At that point, when we talk about the 1960s, was there an appetite to say, actually, this is an outdated law now? Very few people actually live by it, and very few take notice of it. Was it just it lived out its purpose and it was naturally coming to an end?
Yeah, pretty much. There were a lot of factors there. And one of the big factors was that more and more, because national prohibition had ended, statewide prohibition had ended, but every county and municipality, you know, could vote on its own whether to have alcohol. And so more and more are allowing it. And so it was easier to get, for one thing. The penalties were higher for moonshining. The ingredients were more expensive. And also you had the arrival of marijuana on the scene, and it was much more profitable for people. So if you're already involved in illegal activity, it was, and this happened a lot, where people just kind of made the transition into growing pot.
Yeah, well,
moonshine. So So it just kind of died out, although, again, it never died out entirely, and it's seen a revival for sure in recent years.
Well, I'll have to come and try some, that's for sure. Thank you very much for your time this afternoon, Daniel. The book's called, am I saying this correctly, Tar Heel Lightning. I'm an English British person. I don't know these words so well. The book's available on our website, tre.radio, and you can get yourself a copy of it there. Thank you, Daniel, for your time this afternoon, and enjoy your moonshine.
All right, thank you.